Today's Teisho will be on case 2 in the Hikigan Roku. Case 2 in the Mumonkan. Case 2 in the Mumonkan. Case 2 in the Mumonkan is entitled Hyakujo's Fox. When Hyakujo Osho delivered a certain series of sermons, an old man always followed the monks to the main hall and listened to him. When the monks left the hall, the old man would also leave. However, one day he remained behind and Hyakujo asked him, "Who are you standing here before me?" The old man replied, "I am not a human being. In the old days of Kashyapa Buddha, I was a head monk living here on this mountain. One day a student asked me, 'Does an enlightened person fall under the yoke of cause and effect or not?' I answered, 'No, he does not.' Since then, I have been doomed to undergo 500 rebirths as a fox. I beg you now to give me the turning word to release me from my life as a fox. Tell me, does a person of enlightenment fall under the yoke of causation or not?' Hyakujo answered, 'He does not ignore causation.' No sooner had the old man heard these words than he was enlightened. Making his bows, he said, 'I am emancipated from my life as a fox. I shall remain on this mountain. But I have a favor to ask of you. Would you please bury my body as that of a dead monk?' Hyakujo had the director of the monks strike with the gavel and inform everyone that after the midday meal there would be a funeral service for a dead monk. The monks wondered at this, saying, 'Everyone is in good health. No one's in the sick ward. What does this mean?' After the meal, Hyakujo led the monks to the foot of a rock on the far side of the mountain, and with his staff, he poked out the dead body of a fox and performed the ceremony of cremation. That evening, he ascended the rostrum and told the monks the whole story. Obaku thereupon asked him, 'The old man gave the wrong answer and was doomed to be a fox for 500 rebirths. Now suppose he had given the right answer, what would happen?' Hyakujo said, 'You come here to me and I will tell you.' Obaku went up to Hyakujo and boxed his ears. Hyakujo clapped his hands with a laugh and said, 'I was thinking that the barbarian had a red beard, but now I see before me the red-bearded barbarian himself.'" Mumon's comment, "Not falling under causation, how could this make the monk a fox? Not ignoring causation, how could this make an old man emancipated? If you come to understand this, you will realize how old Hyakujo would have enjoyed 500 rebirths as a fox." Mumon's verse, "Not falling, not ignoring, two faces of one die, not ignoring, not falling, 1,000 errors, 1,000,000 mistakes." So I want to thank everybody for coming to practice this morning on this beautiful day, and for sitting so well. Everybody here in person and also online was sitting with such diligence and energy. really wonderful energy, you know, just very clear, wonderful to see. So thank you so much. So this is a wonderful koan, and if we haven't had a chance to do it yet, I certainly hope we will. And as usual, anything I happen to say about the koan will be of no use to you at all if you actually work with it. So let me just say a little bit about koans. We have someone here today who's new to Zen, and the story itself may not make much sense, and this talk of koans might not make much sense either. But koans are, you could just say, they are stories collected by a number of monks in the 11th and 12th century in China. And they describe moments when people have an enlightenment experience, when they actually have an experience of awakened consciousness. So, you know, even people who don't know much about Buddhism understand this idea of enlightenment. Somehow that resonates with ordinary human beings. You know, every once in a while, we have experiences that are like heightened experiences of heightened awareness, right? And we don't necessarily think about it in those terms while it's happening, but maybe after the fact we realize that was kind of an extraordinary thing, you know. It's possible that these experiences can take many different forms, right? I mean, I remember the first time I was hiking in the Pecos wilderness, and I had no idea what to expect. But there was one morning where I got up and I was on a ridge, and I could see, I think it's Mount Taylor, this snow-capped peak. And it was as though I was on some magic dust. Everything just seemed absolutely alive and enchanted. And it was as though, you know, so many things had maybe, it was definitely the case that many things in my life had not gone as planned. And there were all kinds of things that seemed to be getting in my way and holding me back. But, you know, that hike, it was just like, is this happening? Am I dreaming this, or is this real, right? And I think we've all had experiences like that, you know. Sometimes they can take, you know, they can be powerful in a different way. Like, a friend of mine was talking about her experience of taking care of her mother and then her mother dying. And, you know, she said that she thought that when her mother died, she would be overcome with grief. You know, she had this image as she's taking care of this woman who's dying. She had this image of this culminating in this moment where she'd just be sobbing. And she said, you know, to her great surprise, when her mother passed away in her arms, she felt this incredible, it was like sense of elation, or a word in English is like grace, right? It's just like, it's as though all of these problems have just disappeared, and we're in this moment with no expectations. We're not holding on to anything. And it seems absolutely, you know, almost like, you know, it just seems, there's nothing to say about it except that it's kind of perfect, right? It's perfect. It's just the pure moment in itself is beyond words and is complete, whole, elevating, elating, all of those terms, you know. It's like, this can happen in other contexts too, right? I mean, sometimes we used to have a musician in our group who played primarily acoustic guitar. And you know, he was once telling me about, you know, he would have these performances. Oh, okay, most of his performances were, you know, just going through the music, right? Going through the music. He worked with a couple other musicians, and he still is playing in New York. And you know, but every once in a while, he said, you know, it would be like, all of a sudden, every note was exactly perfect, you know, and it's the same music you've been playing every night, but something about that experience, at that moment, it was like the music was playing itself, and the audience was like, you know, just like there. You know, sometimes if you do anything in public, the audience sometimes isn't there, right? They're just somewhere else. They're sort of having their drinks and listening to, but this, he said, you know, he could see the audience was there with him. And that in itself is like really rare. And then he was really on. It's like the music was coming from a place deeper than himself, right? And you know, it was like he couldn't make a mistake. He couldn't make a mistake, right? It was just like flowing, that flowing experience. So I think that people have a kind of intuitive understanding of what Buddhism means when it talks about enlightenment. Right? That in our lives, in big ways or little ways, we've all had these sort of experiences where everything clears away and the pure presence of the moment is right there and we're with it, right? And in Buddhism, there's actually a word for this. This is called thusness. Thusness. It's kind of a stuffy word. In Sanskrit, which was the language of Buddhism for many centuries, it's called tat-atta. Kind of hard to say. Tat-atta. But it just means, it's like right now, this moment is here, you know, perfectly. And there's nothing we need to say, nothing we need to do, it's just absolutely unfolding. And those moments are rare in life, but they do happen to people, right? And I think that's why we all have this sort of instinctual or deeply ingrained craving. You know, once you've had a couple of moments like that, you crave them, right? You want them to happen again. And one of the interesting things about that is that you can't make them happen again. This is really, I think, one of the most fascinating aspects of reality. You know, I have that hike I talked about where everything seemed to be just perfect. It was like, you know, like for much of the hike, I could hear there was like a stream along the trail and it's splashing over the stones and, you know, basically toward the end of the day, the shadows got deeper and, you know, a couple of years later, I had the chance to hike in the Pecos Mountains again. And I took that same trail and it was like beautiful, pretty, but it was like the magic, whatever that was, the thusness wasn't there at that moment, right? And it was a beautiful day, it was a nice hike, but I tried to recapture that experience and I couldn't make it happen again. And this is like a big mystery, right? If you, you know, the first time you see the Grand Canyon, maybe, you know, I've had the chance when I was younger to hike down to the bottom of the Grand Canyon and hike back up. And again, that was one of those experiences where it was just like, how do you top this? Like everything was perfect. When I was hiking down, there was some guy, this was back in the hippie days, there was somebody with a big tie-dye shirt and a flute. And he was playing like Mozart or something, you know, and it was reverberating around the canyon, the trail, I think it was the Bright Angel Trail. It's like, ah! you know, if you go back, you know, might not have a guy with a flute, but even if there is a guy with the flute, it's not the same experience. You know, that would be quite an odd coincidence, right? But you can't make it happen. And that's an, it's not the setting, you know, it's not just you, right? It's a combination of factors. But, you know, enlightenment is, when Buddhists talk about enlightenment, they mean that experience. And you know, Buddhism is really, the basic belief of Buddhism is that those experiences are actually closer, give us a closer look at reality than our ordinary experience. See? So, you know, a lot of the time we don't have experiences like that because we're in our heads, right? You know, so if you're lost in, you know, you're in a cycle of worry, you know, you might be walking through some of the most beautiful, a cycle of worry or a cycle of anger or a cycle of envy or a cycle of feeling defeated, you know, all of these cycles, right? You could be walking through the most beautiful valley in the world and you might never even notice it. Right, you won't, because you're not in the right, you're not receptive, right? And so, you know, Buddhism says, you know, much of the time our experience of reality is distorted by our mental habits, and that those moments of, like you could say, peak experiences or thusness are actually like closer to reality than our ordinary everyday experience, which is encumbered by all these mental habits that, you know, make us feel very distant and detached from the world around us and from the people around us. So Zen, you know, Buddhism in general, and Zen in particular, is like an art of enlightenment. You know, how do we have those experiences more often? And actually, you can have those experiences more often. And the more often you have them, the more fully your own relationship to the world changes, you know, very profoundly. So having those awakening experiences is good for you. And when you see the world in that way, you're seeing it unencumbered by your fears and your attachments and your projections, all of these things to get in the way. And so Buddhism says, how do we have those experiences more often, right? And you could just let them happen by accident, but, you know, actually, you know, when you get, the older you get, I think the harder it becomes to have such experiences. I don't think that's always true, but I think it's often true that as you get older, those kinds of breakthrough or peak experiences can become very rare. And that too is like really interesting. You can't make them happen. And as you get older, they may happen less and less. And, you know, I think that they happen less and less because as we are living our lives, we tend to repeat the same old mental habits over and over again. When you're younger, you know, you're less committed to a certain set of mental habits than when you're older. And as you keep repeating your mental habits, they become more and more compelling and seem more and more like they're real, right? Some people have mental habits like envy, right? Maybe when you were a little kid, you had a sibling and your parents showed more affection to the sibling than to you. This is, This is something I experienced myself as a kid. You know, my parents would say, oh, we love you all equally. But my brother, and I don't blame my parents. My brother, I love my brother a lot. You know, my brother was a very lovable kid. He was like funny, unpretentious. He was like Huckleberry Finn, right? You know, he was like a very natural, and he was, you know, very handsome kid. He was funny. He seemed, he could get along with people. I was very self-conscious. You know, I was sort of, felt always sort of awkward. My brother was sort of like, without trying to be, he was sort of charming. And my parents just liked my brother. They liked being around him, right? It was like so clearly, it was pleasant for them to be around. And I understand, you know, I liked. But, you know, at some point in my life, I think at first unconsciously and then consciously, I began to be very hurt by this, you know. And I began to envy my brother and get into a very competitive relationship with my brother, right? I realized later on through Zen practice how often I was like in this competitive place with other people, right? And I've certainly, as a Zen teacher, I've seen it in many other people as well, right? But I could definitely see, in my Zen practice, through my meditation practice, I've become aware of how I carry around sometimes with me a kind of a default envy mechanism, you know. And it has both has the competitive side and the criticism of yourself side, right? And, you know, I was totally unaware of this for like 35 years. And then, you know, in my Zen practice, at a meditation retreat, I was working on a koan, one of these Zen stories that I'm talking about. And I had this breakthrough. I realized, oh my gosh, you know, so much of my life has been controlled by envy, right? Controlled by envy. I've wasted years of my life, you know, in this stupid mental habit. And, you know, if it hadn't been for Zen, I think I might have gone through my whole life like that. And I've certainly met other people who are like that, you know. So, I had a friend of mine who, she's written two books. And, you know, professors, academics are pretty competitive. They're very competitive. So my friend had written two books, and that was it. She didn't really have a third book in her, but, you know, if you get two books, you get to be a professor at most places. And so she got her two books done, and she became a professor. But she felt impoverished by not having done another book. We were talking over lunch, and I mentioned that somebody had just put out another book, and that I didn't say his third book, but I just said, oh, you know, so-and-so's book just came out. It's really interesting. And she went, what? Another book? And it was like, you could just see like that. And by the way, I love this person. She's a wonderful person, but you could just see that sense of being threatened or like, oh no, you know, another person with a third book and I have only two, right? And you know, it's not a character defect. It's a mental habit that somehow in her life she must have picked up something like this the same way I did, you know. You know, my brother was in sports. He was so good in sports. And, you know, I used to be the last kid they would choose when they chose sides for baseball. Because I'd be the one in the outfield. The ball would be coming down and I'd think, I've got to catch this. And I wouldn't catch it, I'd drop the ball. It's like, oh, Spellmeyer, you're a loser. But my brother, Peter, he'd catch it like in the bare hands, and then everybody would think, oh my God, he's a god, right? So we all have stuff like this. Anyway, we all pick up these mental habits, right, that prevent us from having those moments of tat-ata, of, you know, like everything's flowing, everything's connected, everything's on. And so, you know, Buddhism says, if that, you know, our normal consciousness is like driven by all of these little compulsive habits. So our reality is very distorted. It's always distorted, right? You know, I mean, it's possible even to just say, think you had a good day, and then you talk to somebody who was had an even better day, and you feel bad about your day. You know, it's like, that's how it works, right? It's like, it's so crazy. But we're all like that, right? We're all, you know, so I guess where I went on my vacation, I went to Costa Rica. Oh my God, you know. So that's just, it's we all have these injuries. We all respond to these injuries and create these like mental habits. So Buddhism says, how can we get people out of this? We can't just leave it to accident, right? And in Zen, the way we do this is that we have this book of stories called koans, and the book of stories have like little scenes where somebody who's trapped in his head or her head suddenly has a breakthrough. See? And it's a different way of teaching. You know, you could describe to people, you know, we could describe to people, here's what your, you know, ordinary everyday consciousness has, these mental loops, and we can't get out, and they're created, and they get deeper over time. And then, you know, the peak experiences happen this way. But, you know, actually reading, you know, the bookstores or the libraries are full of such books, but they actually don't help. They don't help. You know, even if you know what your mental habits, your destructive mental habits might be, how do you get out of them, right? And so you know, basically, instead of giving you specific instructions, in Zen there's like a collection of stories that show people having moments of insight or moments of enlightenment, right? And, you know, instead of, they're like teaching by example, right, instead of teaching by instruction. So, you know, in a way, each of the koans is asking you to put yourself in the place of the person in the story who has the breakthrough. And you don't quite know how to do that, but if you meditate with the koan long enough, you begin to understand that situation, right? And you sort of discover something about yourself, right? In the process, you discover your obstacle or your particular destructive mental habit, and then, you know, you have to work your way out. And the way we work our way out is to go into emptiness. So if you're just starting meditation, you probably haven't made the company of emptiness yet. But if you sit on the cushion and you watch your breath, and you do this half an hour a day for the next 3 weeks, let's say, or half an hour four times a week for the next 3 weeks, you know, one day you're going to sit down on the cushion and you're going to feel like $1,000,000. And you're going to say, I don't know why I feel so good right now. And that's stage number one in Zen practice. That's samadhi. That's where we stop being captured by our thoughts. And we're just able to be present in the moment in a non-conceptual way without thinking too much. And then if you keep watching the breath after you can go into samadhi, you eventually notice that your mind becomes very blank. And this blankness is where we go when we want to work on a koan. And every koan has like a little turning phrase, right? Or like a mantra. You recite the mantra while your mind is blank, and gradually you identify with the main character in the koan, and you find yourself going through something similar and hopefully having a breakthrough. So in this story, this is a story about a person who is looks like a human being, but is really a fox. So Yakujo is a great Tang Dynasty Chinese meditation master in the Chan, in the Zen school. And he gives talks just like this one. Hopefully they're better than this one. But he gives talks and people, all his monks and nuns come and people from the village. And there's always this old guy. And one day the old guy doesn't leave. He waits and Yakujo goes up to him and says, you know, who are you anyway? And the old man says, you know, I look like a human being, but I am a fox. And he says, you know, I became a fox because I made a mistake, and I don't know how to get out of my mistake. And he said, you know, 500 lifetimes ago, on this very spot, I was the Zen master, you know. And I was giving a teisho, just like you did today. And a student came up to me after the talk and he said, oh, enlightenment sounds so great. Does an enlightened person have to worry, basically, about life anymore, you know, about things that happen in the world? Or is that person sort of like immune from all of those problems? And I told him, oh, if you're enlightened, no more problems. It's great. And he said, of course, I see now that that wasn't the right answer to give. Because I have, instead of being reborn as a human, I have been reborn as a fox for 500 lifetimes. And I don't know how to make it stop. I don't know how to stop being a fox. So, help! The thing is, you know, this koan is really all about our destructive mental cycles. Right? So being reborn as a fox here, and by the way, I love foxes, just for the record, you know. There's a fox in our neighborhood, and everybody loves him and his partner. He has a female partner, and they must have kits somewhere. And we leave an egg out for the fox every night, and he comes and gets his egg. He never fails. Even in winter, he will come and get his egg. We have a particular place where we put it, and every morning it's gone. No shells. He must carry it off, right? So I love foxes, and sometimes we'll see the fox in the morning hunting squirrels, right? And I love squirrels too, but foxes have to eat, and we have a million squirrels. So, but in this case, the fox is a symbol of basically, you could say, kind of like self-deceit, right? Self-deceit. So the fox is somebody who has made some kind of mistake but doesn't quite know what the mistake was, but is trapped in cycles of repetition from which she or he cannot escape. So this is so human, right? This is all about, you know, what we all do. Is, you know, I talked about my relationship with my brother. And we all have these things. We all have these fox behaviors, right? We don't necessarily know it, right? For a long time, we're just unhappy, but we're repeating, right? It's like my wife and her mother, when we would go out to New Mexico to visit my in-laws, my wife and my mother, my wife and her mother would have about 3 days before they started having a lot of tension. It was like, oh, it's day three, you know. And my wife would go out to see her family with the best of intentions, right? It's like, I'm going to work it out with my mother. But it never worked out. It would be like day three, Shirley, my mother-in-law would basically verbally stab my wife in the hand with some comment, and then there would be all this unhappiness and tension. So this is like a cycle, right? And people don't know how to get out of it. Sometimes in relationships, people have this, right? Like in married relationships, you can be in this cycle where it turns into like this hellish cycle, and you don't know how to get out. And so people go to like a marriage therapist or marriage counselor, couples therapist, marriage counselor, and that person sort of can be outside of the cycle and sort of say, well, try this, try that, you know, so outside the cycle can help you. We all have these, there are writers like Ernest Hemingway is such a good example of somebody who had these cycles he couldn't escape from. You know, Hemingway had this tremendous ambition to be a great writer, and he was a great writer, but he was also like this super super sociable person. You know, so to be a great writer, you have to isolate yourself. And spend long periods of time by yourself, sitting in front of your pad of paper or your typewriter or your computer, and that caused him a lot of grief, a lot of unhappiness. And you know, to be then he would go out and socialize, and he was a very, he desperately needed people to approve of him and say, oh, Ernest, you're so manly, you're so brilliant, you're so handsome, you know. And if he didn't get that, he felt terrible, right? So, and when he was getting the strokes from everybody, he wasn't writing, right? So he was in this cycle of going from loneliness to, you know, feeling like he was betraying himself, lonely, you know. We all have these things, right? And, you know, it's possible if we practice meditation, to think that this path is going to get us out of those, and it will, right? It will. But how will it get us out of those? That's the question. See, that's the big question here. So we all, you know, in Buddhism we talk about nirvana or enlightenment, and the opposite of nirvana is samsara. Samsara is like unenlightenment. But you know, the word samsara actually means going around and around in a circle. That's what it means. So when the Buddha talked about unhappiness, he said, you know, going around in a circle is unhappiness. And because we keep repeating these behaviors that are destructive or that make us feel unhappy or separate, and we don't know how to get out of them. See? So people get interested in Buddhism because they want to be happy, right? They definitely want to be, everybody wants to, I think most people want to be happy. Most people want to have peak experiences. So one way to do this is to try to just have things in your life that make you feel good and happy.
Right.
And, you know, basically, you might think that, you know, in order to have a more whole, you know, to get to those peak experiences, you need to try to screen out the bad things and focus on the good things. This is very common, right? It's like, so why, why pay attention to the things that bring you down? Just focus on the happy things, right? You know, so, you know, you'll hear people say, why is it that the New York Times always reports on the sad things? Why don't we get reports on the good things, right? And what they're saying is, I feel that these sad things are bringing me down. I want some happy news. And the idea is, and I like happy news too, it's good. But the idea is, if I can just fill my life with things that make me feel happy, I will be a happier person, see. That's the logic. And the world of like spirituality is filled with this kind of mentality, right? So basically, you know, in ancient China, not just China, but India, United States, you know, in ancient China, they had all of these strategies for becoming happy. So, basically, Taoists had all of these, you know, the human body is like a distillery. And if you learn to direct the qi in the proper way, you purify the body, see? And basically, the qi rises up to your head and you have an enlightenment experience. And there were all these dietary regimens, right? If you want to be happy, you know, only eat, you know, these things. Don't eat these things. There was like a happiness industry in China, you know. And that's true here in the United States too. There's like a happiness industry, the happiness industrial complex. So everybody wants, you know, everybody wants to be happy, so you do things that make you happy, you read happy news, you try not to hang around with people who are a downer, you change your diet so you always feel good after you eat, you know, and things like that. I actually think that this koan is very skeptical about that as a strategy, right? See, if you're pursuing happiness in the wrong way, let's say, you're actually like closing yourself off from lots of things that could be liberating. And you're actually like making your world, I'm not against happiness, I'm really in favor of happiness, and the koan is too, but it's saying, don't try to always be happy. It's very important for us to engage with the things that make us unhappy, and understand them. So if we're always just trying to look on the bright side, you know, if we're only trying to be like eat pure food and live a good, you know, perfect life, you know, so there's a way of trying to remove all darkness from your life, all sadness from your life, all challenges from your life. See, the koan's kind of saying, if you do that, you're not going to liberate yourself. You're just going to be like this fox, living life after life, repeating the same mental habits. But, you know, there's a word that I like a lot. It's called spiritual bypassing. You've probably heard that term. But, you know, psychotherapists realize that there are a lot of people who have been meditating for like 30 years who were depressed. There's some articles on this that were really interesting. These therapists were very interested in meditation, and they had these clients who had been meditating for 30 years, and the clients said, oh, we're really depressed. And he said, how's that possible? So basically, when these people meditated, right, they would go into this state of samadhi where you feel very safe and connected, very balanced. Everything is beautiful in samadhi. It's really like beautiful. I myself love samadhi. And, you know, when I started doing meditation, I was rather unhappy, and I began to get into this happy place, and I just loved it. I would go to the Zen Center and go into samadhi, and it was so, it's like eating sugar, you know, so good, you know. And I loved it, you know, and then, but, you know, a good teacher won't let you stay there. The good teacher will say, look, you know, let's work on a koan. And you start working on the koan, and you suddenly don't feel necessarily so happy. Now, if you're working on a koan, it's not your job to be unhappy. So I'm not saying all koans should make you unhappy. But a lot of koans deal with things in our life that are darkness areas or tension areas, or you know, suddenly you're working on a koan and you become angry. And you know, you could say, well, this is no good. I want to be happy. I want to be calm. I want to be... But see, why is that anchor there? See, the koan is saying, when you feel something less than perfect, that's where you can wake up. See, your happy moments, a lot can be learned from happy moments, but much more can be learned from unhappy moments, see. Because, you know, basically the unhappy moments hold the key to a bigger insight. So I hope that's making some sense. You know, if it's a sunny day and you just got a promotion and somebody wrote you a letter and said, I must meet with you, I'm madly in love with you, you're charming and you know, it's like, oh, that was a nice day. But not much can be, in terms of the quest for awakening, not much can be learned from that. But you know, basically, when you know the person in the desk next to you gets the promotion, and there's a part of you that just wants to kill him, right? You know, and you realize, you start sniping at this person, you start grousing about, you know, what a phony he is, and so on. All of a sudden, you realize, you know. You almost like, I almost hate that guy. And then you realize, you know, what is that all about? What is that? You know, this person is a nice guy, you know. Why do I hate him right now? You know, and by the way, why do I hate myself? See, so now that's where it's like, that's where the enlightenment can happen. That's the door to our bigger mind. That's the door to our breakthrough. So again, I'm not saying you should always be unhappy, always do things that make you unhappy, but not much can be learned from those happy moments. The most that can be learned is from those moments where you suddenly see your anger, or you suddenly see your fear, or you suddenly see your distrust, right? And that's hard to come to terms with. But when you see that stuff, if you back away, you're losing a precious opportunity to stop being reborn as a fox. And so the koan, you know, this person said, I don't want to deal with my obstacles. I just want to be in samadhi. I just want the sweetness of samadhi. Those moments of just like bliss on the cushion are so sweet. And they come many times, but if you get attached to them, they become an obstacle. That's why this is the second koan in the Mumonkan. First, people learn how to enter samadhi and emptiness, and then, you know, Master Mumon is coming along and saying, but don't stay there, you know, look for the things that we don't want to see in our life, the things that make us anxious. Anxiety, right? We think, I just want to get away from anxiety, right? But why not say, where is this anxiety coming from? And, you know, when we're in deep mushin and we're working on a koan like this, we can suddenly feel very anxious. And not necessarily, sometimes koans don't affect you that way, but sometimes you can feel anxious or fearful. And, you know, instead of saying, oh, I shouldn't be feeling this, this is not a unified state of being, this is not an enlightened state, no. Stay with that fear, stay with that anger, stay with that envy, and see what it reveals to you, see. And you know, you suddenly become aware of how much of your life has been controlled by your envy. And maybe you even see how it all begins. You see yourself sitting in the living room and your parents are laughing with your brother and you're sitting over in the corner looking at the TV. And then you realize, oh, I've been repeating that drama for 35 years, right? You know, and then, you know, what can happen is, you know, you feel, you know, in a way, you feel compassion for yourself. You don't blame yourself, you don't blame your brother, you know, these are things that happen to you, but you have a breakthrough and you just stop feeling these conditioned responses. You know, and, you know, it may not happen in one moment of insight, but little by little, envy stops being your friend. You know, it stops controlling your behavior. And you find yourself motivated by other motives, like, you know, caring about other people, or, you know, your default position is no longer envy. It's maybe just compassion or care or interest. And it's hard to be interested in other people when you're envious of them. So this koan is about, you know, how the things that bother us in life are these wonderful opportunities to wake up if we have the toolkit. And the toolkit is zazen, and the toolkit is samadhi, and the toolkit is mushin. And if we sit in mushin and we discover our obstacles and we work through them, that's when the enlightenment moments come. When Hyakujo Osho delivered a series of sermons, an old man always followed the monks to the main hall and listened to him. When the monks left the hall, the old man would also leave. One day, however, he remained behind, and Hyakujo asked him, "Who are you standing here before me?" The old man replied, "I am not a human being. In the old days of Kashyapa Buddha," that's the previous Buddha, like a million years ago, "I was a head monk living on this mountain. One day a student asked me, 'Does a person of enlightenment fall under cause and effect or not? Does a person of enlightenment care about problems or not?' I answered, 'No, he does not.' Since then I have been doomed to undergo 500 rebirths as a fox. I beg you now to give me a turning word to release me from my life as a fox. Tell me, does a man of enlightenment fall under the yoke of causation or not?" Hyakujo answered, "He doesn't ignore causation." Or he, another answer, "He explores causation." No sooner had the old man heard these words than he was enlightened. Making his bows, he said, "I am emancipated. You've broken the cycle. I shall remain on this mountain. I have a favor to ask you. Would you please bury my body as that of a dead monk?" Hyakujo had the director of the monks, the Karmadana, strike the gavel and inform everyone that after the midday meal, there would be a funeral service for the dead monk. The monks wondered at this, saying, "Everyone is in good health. No one is in the sick ward. What does this mean?" After the meal, Hyakujo led the monks to the foot of a rock on the far side of the mountain, and with his staff, he poked out the dead body of a fox and performed the ceremony of cremation. That evening, he ascended the rostrum and told the monks the whole story. Obaku, his student, thereupon asked him. The old man gave the wrong answer and was doomed to be a fox for 500 rebirths. Now, suppose he had given the right answer, what would have happened then? Hyakujo says, "Come here and I'll tell you." Obaku went up to Hyakujo and boxed his ears. Hyakujo clapped his hands with a laugh and said, I was thinking that the barbarian had a red beard, but now I see before me the red-bearded barbarian himself." Momon's comment, "Not falling under causation, how could this make the monk a fox? Not ignoring causation, how could this make the old man emancipated? If you come to understand this, you will realize how old Hyakujo would have enjoyed 500 rebirths as a fox. Not falling, not ignoring. Two faces of one die. Not ignoring, not falling. 1,000 errors, 1,000,000 mistakes."